Good evening. Bernie Sanders falls ill and temporarily suspends his campaign as he recovers from a heart procedure. With that and other stories, I'm Paul DiRienzo with the news for October 2nd, 2019. Senator Bernie Sanders underwent an unexpected heart procedure on Tuesday for a blockage in an artery and canceled campaign events for the White House until further notice. The 78-year-old presidential contender was in Las Vegas, Nevada for 2020 presidential campaign events. According to campaign officials, he experienced discomfort and was taken to a hospital for evaluation. Sanders' senior advisor Jeff Weaver said in a statement, he was found to have a blockage in one artery and two stents were successfully inserted. Weaver added, Senator Sanders is conversing and in good spirits. He will be resting up over the next few days. We are canceling his events and appearances until further notice. Sanders, the oldest of 19 contenders for the Democratic presidential nomination, was scheduled to appear at a gun safety forum and a town hall meeting in Las Vegas. Sanders is one of 12 candidates scheduled to participate in the fourth Democratic debate in Ohio on October 15th. The first nominating contest is not until February 3rd in Iowa. In a letter made public during the 2016 campaign, Sanders' doctor said he was in overall good health and he had no history of cardiovascular disease. Just under 1 million stents are implanted in coronary arteries each year. In general, recovery takes a few days. A cardiologist at the Cleveland Clinic, Dr. Steven Nissen, says people recover quickly and assuming no complications, there's no reason why he could not get back on the campaign trail in a timely fashion. And in more political news, an obviously enraged President Donald Trump, his face flush and mouth gaping in anger, denounced an impeachment inquiry into his July telephone call with Ukraine's leader on Wednesday. His comments came as Democratic lawmakers said they would subpoena White House records about the call. At a joint news conference with Finland's president, a frustrated Trump blasted reporters who asked about the probe, which he called a hoax and a fraud, but said he would cooperate with the inquiry, telling reporters, "I always cooperate."
The whistleblower was very inaccurate. The whistleblower started this whole thing by writing a report on the conversation I had with the president of Ukraine. And the conversation was perfect. It couldn't have been nicer. I saw Rick Scott. I saw many of the senators talking about it, many of the congressmen talking about it. Not a thing wrong. Unless you heard the Adam Schiff version where he made up my conversation. He actually made it up. It should be criminal. It should be treasonous. He made it up, every word of it, made up, and read to Congress as though I said it. And I'll tell you what, he should be forced to resign from Congress, Adam Schiff. He's a lowlife. He should be forced to resign. He took a perfect conversation, realized he couldn't read it to Congress because it was perfect. It was a very nice conversation. I knew many people were on the phone. Not only were many people on the phone, we had stenographers on the phone taking it down word for word. He took that conversation, which was perfect. He said, "I can't read this." So he made up a conversation. And he reported it and said it to Congress and to the American people. And it was horrible what he said. And that was supposed to be coming from me. But it was all fabricated. He should resign from office in disgrace. And frankly, they should look at him for treason because he is making up the words of the President of the United States. Not only words, but the meaning. And it's a disgrace. It should not be allowed to happen.
Trump has been responding to statements made by House Intelligence Chair Adam Schiff characterizing Trump's call with Ukraine's President Zelensky as like a mobster making an offer he couldn't refuse.
Shorn of its rambling character and in not so many words, this is the essence of what the president communicates. We've been very good to your country, very good. No other country has done as much as we have. But you know what? I don't see much reciprocity here. I hear what you want. I have a favor I want from you, though. And I'm going to say this only seven times, so you better listen good. I want you to make up dirt on my political opponent, understand lots of it. On this and on that, I'm going to put you in touch with people, not just any people. I'm going to put you in touch with Attorney General of the United States, my Attorney General, Bill Barr. He's got the whole weight of the American law enforcement behind him. And I'm going to put you in touch with Rudy. You're going to love him, trust me. You know what I'm asking, and so I'm only going to say this a few more times, in a few more ways. And by the way, don't call me again. I'll call you when you've done what I asked. This is, in sum, in character, what the president was trying to communicate.
Meanwhile, U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo acknowledged earlier in the day during a trip to Italy that he had listened in on the call with Zelensky.
As for was I on the phone call, I was on the phone call. The phone call was in the context of now, I guess I've been the Secretary of State for coming on a year and a half. I know precisely what the American policy is with respect to Ukraine. It's been remarkably consistent, and we will continue to try to drive those set of outcomes. It's what our team, including Ambassador Volker, were focused on, was taking down the threat that Russia poses there in Ukraine. It was about helping the Ukrainians to get graft out and corruption outside of their government, and to help now this new government in the Ukraine build a successful, thriving economy. It's what the State Department officials that I had the privilege to lead have been engaged in, and it's what we will continue to do, even while all this noise is going on.
And transcripts of the call appear to show Trump asking Zelensky to investigate Joe Biden, a former U.S. vice president and a leading contender for the Democratic nomination to face Trump in the 2020 presidential election. Pompeo went on to accuse the House of bullying State Department employees to get information for their impeachment probe.
What the folks on Capitol Hill have asked is fundamentally not true. What we objected to was the demands that were put that are deeply violate fundamental principles of separation of powers. They contacted State Department employees directly, told them not to contact legal counsel at the State Department. At least that's been reported to us. They said that the State Department wouldn't be able to be present. There are important constitutional prerogatives that the executive branch has to be present so that we can protect important information. So our partners, countries like Italy, can have confidence that the information that they provide the State Department will continue to be protected. And so the response that I provided to them was one that acknowledged that we will, of course, do our constitutional duty to cooperate with this co-equal branch. But we are going to do so in a way that is consistent with the fundamental values of the American system. And we won't tolerate folks on Capitol Hill bullying, intimidating State Department employees. That's unacceptable, and it's not something that I'm going to permit to happen.
Also on Wednesday, House Intelligence Chair Schiff briefed reporters with House Speaker Nancy Pelosi on where the investigation stands.
Last Thursday, the Intelligence Committee held an open hearing with the Acting Director of National Intelligence. The following day, Chairman Engel issued a subpoena to the State Department in close consultation with myself and Chairman Cummings. We are deeply concerned about Secretary Pompeo's effort now to potentially interfere with witnesses whose testimony is needed before our committee, many of whom are mentioned in the whistleblower complaint. And we want to make it abundantly clear that any effort by the Secretary, by the President, or anyone else to interfere with the Congress's ability to call before it relevant witnesses will be considered as evidence of obstruction of the lawful functions of Congress. And more than that, will allow an adverse inference to be drawn as to the underlying facts, that if they are going to prevent witnesses from coming forward to testify on the allegations in the whistleblower complaint, that will create an adverse inference that those allegations are in fact correct. On Monday, I issued a subpoena to Rudy Giuliani, again in consultation with Chairman Cummings and Engel. We expect Mr. Giuliani to comply with the legal process we are using. He is obviously a key figure in all of this by his own admission, as well as by the allegations in the whistleblower complaint. Today, and just within the last hour, half hour, Chairman Cummings noticed a subpoena that will go out later this week or next week after the notice period has expired, that committee intends to subpoena documents that the White House has been withholding from Congress. We are obviously coordinating very closely with Chairman Cummings on that. On Thursday, Ambassador Volker is scheduled to appear before our committee. And on Friday, the Inspector General of the IC, Mr. Atkinson, will appear before the committee and testify as well. The last time that the Inspector General testified, we did not have the complaint. We now do. And we certainly intend to ask the director about the efforts that were made to corroborate that complaint, which we now know the Inspector General found both credible and urgent. Next week, we have also scheduled a deposition or interview with the former U.S. Ambassador Yovanovitch to Ukraine. And we are in discussion with other State Department witnesses to secure their depositions. So we've been very busy, as you can tell, this week. We're going to be very busy again next week. We are proceeding deliberately, but at the same time, we feel a real sense of urgency here that this work needs to get done, and it needs to get done in a responsible period of time.
And Pelosi added that the House does not need to vote on continuing its inquiry, but that such a vote would be unwelcome by the GOP.
Mr. Speaker, on impeachment, have you taken off the table, or do you plan for a full House vote on an impeachment inquiry?
There's no requirement that there be a full vote.
That's not anything that is excluded. And by the way, there's some Republicans that are very nervous about our bringing that vote to the floor.
Time magazine reports that at least 224 of the 435 members of the House of Representatives have said they support the impeachment inquiry. All are Democrats except independent Representative Justin Amash of Michigan, formerly a Republican. Polls show that since the impeachment inquiry began, support has shot up precipitously. Now, 79.6% of Democrats, 41.9% of independents, and 12.1% of Republicans are supporting the inquiry. No similar increase was seen after the report by Special Prosecutor Robert Mueller was released, or Mueller's testimony to Congress. Adam Schiff also added in today's remarks that any attempt to frustrate the House impeachment inquiry by the executive branch would be seen as evidence of obstruction of justice.
We are concerned that the White House will attempt to stonewall our investigation, much as they have stonewalled other committees in the past. It's why I say the White House needs to understand that any action like that, that forces us to litigate or have to consider litigation will be considered further evidence of obstruction of justice. And, of course, that was an article of impeachment against Nixon, the obstruction of the lawful functions of Congress, that is. We will also draw the inference, though, as appropriate, that they are trying to conceal facts that would corroborate the allegations in the whistleblower complaint. So we'll have to decide whether to litigate or how to litigate. We're not fooling around here, though. We don't want this to drag on months and months and months, which appears to be the administration's strategy. So they just need to know that even as they try to undermine our ability to find the facts around the president's effort to coerce a foreign leader to create dirt that he can use against a political opponent, that they will be strengthening the case on obstruction if they behave that way.
Meanwhile, in the latest search for information, House Oversight Committee Chairman Elijah Cummings says he intends to subpoena the White House for Ukraine-related records on Friday. Trump seemed to make light of the request, telling reporters that Pelosi hands out subpoenas like they're cookies. And the former Dallas police officer convicted of murder in the shooting death of her neighbor inside his apartment was sentenced today. The jury sentenced Amber Geiger to 10 years in prison for the September 2018 killing of her upstairs neighbor, Motham Jean. And this is the news on WBAI, listener-sponsored radio in New York. I'm Paul DiRienzo. The father of Julian Assange, the founder of WikiLeaks, says his son is being subjected to harsh measures at England's notorious Belmarsh prison, where he's imprisoned for bail jumping. John Shipton, speaking at a Berlin news conference with members of Die Linke, or the Left Party, in the German parliament, said this.
So that he's 22 to 23 hours a day in solitary confinement. As a prisoner, no access to the gym, no access to computers, no access to the means of defending himself in the case that's coming up in February. He's now on remand after serving 50 weeks. And as a remand prisoner, Julian suffered loss of weight, 15 kilo, and had to be transferred to the prison hospital, where he still resides today. Those few people, Chelsea Manning, Julian Assange, and WikiLeaks, is just a handful of people, probably more than, not more than it's in this room, less, have brought to us immense benefits, uncalculable benefits to people, to individuals, to know where the war crimes are, why seven countries have been destroyed in 20 years.
And that's John Shipton, the father of Julian Assange. Assange is awaiting a hearing that could have him extradited to the United States to face espionage charges punishable by up to 175 years in prison. And in more international news, today marks 1 year since journalist Jamal Khashoggi was murdered in the Saudi Arabia consulate in Istanbul, Turkey. Khashoggi, a Saudi dissident who reported for the Washington Post and other publications, had entered the embassy to get papers he needed to marry his fiancée. The couple was planning to divide their time between living in the United States and Turkey. Khashoggi entered the consulate at 1:42 p.m. He was never seen leaving. His fiancée, Hatice Sengez, called inside and was told Khashoggi was no longer there. She describes their last days together as they busied themselves preparing for their life together.
When we woke up that morning, there was no worry or bad feeling in my mind or heart. This was not our first time there. Jamal was also very comfortable. We had not even talked about whether or not we should go to the consulate. I just asked him who he would be going there with, and he told me a friend. He didn't give me the name. At that moment, I was a bit worried, thinking he would go alone. I had classes, so I cancelled them and joined Jamal.
Because he had visited 4 days beforehand, I think, on the 28th of September. What was the reception he got that day? He went in and everything was okay?
That visit happened a bit spontaneously because we first visited the Turkish municipality on the day. Jamal wanted to hear from the authorities himself exactly what papers were needed. Jamal didn't want to go to the consulate himself for these papers. He was trying to figure out if he could get the papers from somewhere else or if we could get married without the papers. Jamal absolutely did not want to go to the consulate. At the municipality, they told him the procedure was that he had to get the necessary papers either from Saudi Arabia or their consulate here. Once he heard that, Jamal said, "Let's try," and then we went to the consulate together. On the way, Jamal was very worried, but of course I did not really grasp how deep his worries were. Looking back, his fears all make sense, but on the day I could not guess what could happen. I just asked him, "What is worrying you so much?" And I said, "We didn't have to go." He said, "We must for the papers." I asked him what could be the worst thing that could happen. He said he didn't want to see the bad face of Saudi Arabia there. He said maybe they would take his passport from him or maybe detain him. So I told him that since I was going there with him and we would be together, such thing would not happen. He agreed. Maybe he got the strength from me or because he really wanted to get married, he took the risk. I don't know.
Thanks to Al Jazeera for that clip. That was Hatice Sengiz, who's the fiancée of Jamal Khashoggi. She was their wedding was cut short by his murder. Within hours, the Saudi consulate in Istanbul was surrounded by media organizations. After days of denial, the Saudi government eventually admitted Khashoggi had been killed by what they called rogue members of the security services. The admission came as Turkish intelligence released recordings of the murder. The journalist is heard protesting as a plastic bag is being put over his head, saying he would be suffocated. Tapes were also revealed that a forensic doctor working for the Saudis had described how he would dismember the body. There were also recordings of a chainsaw in operation from inside the consulate. Eventually, Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman took what he claimed was full responsibility for Khashoggi's murder. Several intelligence officers charged by the Saudis as part of what's been called a rogue operation are currently on trial in the Desert Kingdom. The proceedings are secret. President Trump has a close relationship with the Saudi royal family. After a period of shuttle diplomacy between Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, some of the worst allegations made by Turkey about the gruesome murder were dialed back. Turkey has released only 45 minutes of more than 7 hours of recordings from the consulate in Istanbul. And a small-scale conflict between the two arch-rivals, Pakistan and India, could ignite a nuclear war that would kill hundreds of millions. That's according to the head of Pakistan's border region, known as Azad Kashmir or Free Kashmir. The statement came just days after Pakistan's Prime Minister Imran Khan addressed India with similar rhetoric at the United Nations. The president of Pakistan, of the Pakistani-controlled part of Kashmir, Masood Khan, was quoted by a Russian news agency as saying even a limited military conflict could evolve into a nuclear war, adding, if a war breaks out between India and Pakistan, it will be quick, dirty, and deadly. It will be an Armageddon. Hundreds of millions will die in South Asia, and 2.5 billion people will be affected by radiation all over the world. But Masood stepped back from the brink in his comments, saying Pakistan isn't seeking war, but that he wants to predict, quote, a realistic scenario so that international community could intervene and pile pressure on India. Last week, Prime Minister Imran Khan warned a bloodbath was brewing in the disputed territory and hinted that weapons of mass destruction could be used against India if war breaks out. In New Delhi, government ministers accused him of warmongering and an obsession with Kashmir. India and Pakistan fought two wars over Kashmir in 1947 and 1965. They fought numerous cross-border skirmishes, most recently in February. At the time, the nuclear-armed neighbors came close to full-scale war. And finally, one of the big issues at this year's United Nations General Assembly, as it is every year, was drugs. A little-known reality is that since 1961, when the UN passed the Single Convention on Drugs, it's been a violation of international treaties for any country to legalize or accept the medical use of cannabis, heroin, and other generally illegal drugs. In fact, until Colorado and Washington State legalized cannabis, no country in the world had ever legalized or approved any use for pot. One of the strongest proponents of drug prohibition was the United States. Today, the U.S. is considered a moderate on drugs. The new tough guy is Russia, which has been pushing for more compliance with the treaties, even as drug laws are being loosened around the world. Heather Hage is a member of the New York NGO Committee on Drugs.
The NGO community is very strong and has been active in the space for the last 20 years and has been working towards, getting rid of these sort of unrealistic goals of this, drug-free world that really just result in these harsh penalties and throwing people in jail and, all the things that they're just not working. So what the NGO community has sought to do is bring evidence that these measures are not working and also bring, push for measures that do work, like harm reduction and treating the issue as a health issue and not a criminal issue. And slowly those things are starting to take hold. So the dialogue at the UN has really changed insofar as it's really moving towards a more public health model and human rights model and slowly moving away from this zero tolerance idea. Although there's a lot of work to do and never finished.
Have any countries been moved by the UN's position to liberalize their drug laws?
It's sort of a chicken and egg thing, isn't it? So I think that, some countries take the initiative on their own and start to liberalize their laws. And I'm thinking about some European countries like Switzerland and even like Mexico and Colombia was there for a while. Now it sort of depends on the administration sometimes. But I think that there is some of that because what happens is that the most progressive countries bring their ideas to the UN and really it's, the UN is made up of leaders and people and they talk and they influence each other. And so over time, countries take back those positions to their own countries. And in my opinion, that's sort of how things start to slowly move forward. There's always going to be those countries that are just not going to move forward. There's been no progress on the death penalty. I shouldn't say no progress because about 5, 6, 7, 8 years ago, the International Narcotics Board they would call out every other infringement or violation of the international drug law treaties, but they would not ever call out a human rights violation. And now we saw when the Philippines had this horrible policy of extrajudicial killings against people who were involved in the drug trade, the INCB came out with a very strong statement denouncing that, and so did UNODC, the UN Office on Drugs and Crime. So things have really changed as far as that goes, but at a member state level, the death penalty has still not been addressed. There are other small things like harm reduction.
What is harm reduction?
instead of pressing people to abstain, it's more about treating people with compassion and make sure that they have health services and that there are interventions like syringe exchange, overdose facilities to keep people safe and to prevent the spread of HIV/AIDS, and just to reach out to people who use drugs and make sure that they get the same health services as other people.
How is the United States seen as a, its leadership as a drug-using country?
It's widely acknowledged that North America has a terrible crisis going on, of course, with the opioids. 5, 6, 7 years ago, the U.S. was much more aligned with the zero-tolerance countries, like Russia, and believe it or not, Sweden is a zero-tolerance country. But over the years, I think the U.S. has become a bit more moderate. They still won't say harm reduction, but they will support specific harm reduction measures. I would say they're not progressive, but they're sort of moderate at this point. They lay low because they have such an issue with cannabis.
The Trump administration and cannabis, as far as the United States and
drug treaties, international controlled drug treaties, starting with the 1961 Single Convention, prohibit any non-scientific or non-medical use of cannabis. So it's really, although some countries like the Netherlands don't enforce their laws, it's really up until a few years ago has been completely illegal. Recreational use has been completely illegal everywhere in the world. So it's just been, it started with Washington and Colorado. Are in violation of the treaties, and that is seen as kind of a big deal at the UN. The treaties themselves are pretty difficult to amend. It would take a unanimous vote to amend the treaties, and the problem is that there are blocks that will block, and there are blocks of countries that will oppose that. Russia being the head of one of the biggest opposition blocks. It's hard to say exactly what will happen. I imagine that more and more countries will legalize and it will become sort of a critical mass. And then at some point, something must be done. At some point, they're going to have to do something because as a general rule, member states do not like to be in violation of treaties. It's not looked upon. It's not something that they want to do. Most countries want to be, you know, good citizens, good world citizens, and they, you know, sometimes suffer different repercussions from staying in violation of a treaty.
Heather Hache is member of the New York NGO Committee on Drugs. And that's some of the news for Wednesday, October 2nd, 2019. The news was produced with Linda Perry. Our engineer is Reggie Johnson. For the WBAI Evening News, I'm Paul DiRienzo.